Welcome to This Is Your Life with Michael Hyatt, where our goal is to give you the clarity, courage, and commitment you need to do what matters. My name is Michelle Cachat. I'm your co-host today, and I'm sitting in the studio with the one, the only, Michael Hyatt.
Hello, Michelle.
I just thought I'd spice it up today.
Yeah, that's a different tack. Yeah, great. I think we should go back to the other one, but that's okay.
Oh, come on. Let's have some fun. All right. So all it takes, honestly, truly, is one look at major news stories in business, diplomacy, entertainment, politics, whatever, to discover that most crises we face begin as a crisis of leadership, right?
Totally. Everything goes back to leadership. I learned that from John Maxwell. He's 100% right. Every crisis, every problem, somewhere there's a failure of leadership.
Oh, which means the good news is, which means that we can help correct that.
We can
start to identify and learn what it takes or what kind of contributes to bad leadership.
That's right. So we may not be able to fix the whole world, but we can at least fix our world by becoming better leaders and taking responsibility.
And so regardless of what type of leadership you're in, so even if you are leading a group of one or two, or if you're leading hundreds, your influence matters because it ends up multiplying.
Yes.
Right? So bad leadership multiplies, good leadership multiplies.
That's right.
And so it's absolutely essential that you and I become the best leaders we can be and know really what creates a lousy leader. So if we can identify those characteristics, we can work to avoid that and then become the best leaders
we can be. Yeah, sometimes we learn better by bad examples. And I remember my daughter telling me one time she was complaining about her boss and what a lousy leader he was. Mm-hmm. And she went into great detail about this. And I finally said to her, honey, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but honestly, you're going to learn way more from a bad leader, from a lousy leader, than you're going to learn from a good one. Because this is going to strengthen your resolve not to be that kind of leader. So soak up everything you can. Don't be too quick to get on to a good leader because not many of them exist. Uh-huh. But you can be one, but absorb the lessons you're getting from this lousy leader.
All right. So our goal today is to help everyone who's listening, including ourselves as we're participating in this conversation, to thrive in our leadership roles wherever we are. And we can do that by avoiding the characteristics of a lousy leader.
Yes.
And we have 10 of them.
That's a lot.
It is a lot.
We'll see if we get through them.
But we're going to do this.
Okay.
So let's start with the first one. We'll dive right into the content, and then we will unpack some of these as we go. What's the very first characteristic of a lousy leader?
It's that they don't have enough confidence to lead at their level. Now, this shows up in some unexpected ways. I worked for a man a couple decades ago who just could never pull the trigger on making a decision. He didn't have the confidence to make the decisions he needed to make. So here's how it looked like from my vantage point as one of his direct reports.
Okay.
I would go into him and I'd say, look, we need to make a decision on X. And I won't reveal too much because it would out the guy.
Okay.
But I would say, we need to make a decision on X. Can you give me your approval? And he'd say, well, I need some more information. So I'd go out. I would have to do a bunch of research. I would bring it back to him. He'd look it over, kind of get into the paralysis of analysis, and he'd say, well, I need some more information. So I would go back out and go through another loop of trying to get him the information that he required. By the time I got him the information to make the decision, the opportunity had passed.
Oh.
It was no longer even an option.
Yes.
And
how frustrating for you to spend that much time.
Literally. I mean, fortunately, I only had to report to this guy for about a year.
Okay.
But it about killed me. I literally almost quit that job because I just said, I can't go through this. I can't get anything done because he doesn't have the confidence to make a decision. And I don't know. I see this in leaders sometimes. It's like they're so afraid to make the wrong decision that they make no decision.
They're paralyzed.
And by de facto, they make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually ends up being the wrong one.
And all that does is foster tons of resentment.
That's right. It does. And so as a leader, you know, kind of the converse of that is you've got to have the confidence to make a decision. Yes, there's a risk in every decision. Yes, sometimes you're going to get it wrong, but you can't hold up your team and the progress of the organization by refusing to act or make a decision.
And at times, making a decision that you later regret and think, oh, yeah, I could have done that differently is better than just inaction.
You can recover from that. I mean, there's not very many decisions that you and I make in our life. I mean, obviously, there's some big ones that we could make. But for most of the decisions that we make, they're not fatal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may be a setback. There may be, some expense involved. But usually we can recover from it. But it's far better than sitting on the sidelines and not acting. The lost opportunity cost there can be huge.
True. All right. So what is the second characteristic of a lousy leader?
Well, that they're arrogant, assuming they always know what's best. You know,
which is almost like, it's almost like the opposite of what we just talked about.
Yeah, it is. And I've seen this in a lot of leaders too, is where they confuse their opinion with the right answer, mm-hmm. you know, as if their opinion was the right answer and there was no difference and mm-hmm. that everybody else in the room was not as smart as they were.
Somewhat
they
narcissistic.
It is. Yeah. And it's obviously limited exposure
mm-hmm.
Because if they'd ever been exposed to really smart people, they'd realize that they don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people that are in leadership position don't recruit the best people that they could recruit because it's a threat to their own command, their own mm-hmm. sense of control. And so it's easy for those people to think they're the smartest person in the room. But arrogance is one of the worst, or one of the, maybe I should say this way, it's one of the best ways to derail your career
mm-hmm.
as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think you know all the answers, you don't have the right team, for starters.
Yes.
You know, and you're not going to have all the information. So somewhere between not knowing enough and thinking you know it all is the right place for a leader. To know enough to make a decision and then move forward.
Well, you have enough
humility.
Confidence in your own abilities to make a decision, but you're still open to the input and ideas of others.
That's right.
That's great. All right. What is the third characteristic of a lousy leader?
Third characteristic, I would say, is they're disorganized.
Hear, hear. I mean, I just love this one because I think organization is such a key part of any time you're leading anything.
Well, let me ask you this question.
I'm kind of compulsive that way.
so, you are.
So maybe that is another bad characteristic. I'm a little too obsessed.
Have you ever worked for a disorganized leader? Not counting me, but...
Oh, yes. Now, I would say I have... Well, let's put it this way. I volunteered for a very disorganized, like in a volunteer or a nonprofit kind of situation where
you're
donating your time for somebody that's very disorganized and you are always feeling like you're trying to make up for their lack.
Yeah.
Because everything's kind of, there's bad communication. You never know what to expect. Nobody is on the same page. And you're volunteering your time after your day job to do this. And it creates a lot of tension and frustration. I mean, the truth is when you have volunteers and if you're that way, they're going to walk. They're not going to stay.
They are. Because
you lose people fast.
It's one thing if you're paying people to stay. I had a boss one time who was incredibly disorganized. You know, I would give him reports and then he would claim that he lost them and almost imply that he never got them. And so I would have to find the email where I had sent the mm-hmm. report in and give it to him again. And I was basically his filing system.
Yes.
Because he couldn't keep track of anything. And worse than that, he couldn't even keep track of his own calendar. So I had every other week meeting with him. And so about half the time I would show up for that meeting and he would keep me waiting for 10, 15, 20 minutes while he finished up another commitment. Just couldn't manage anything to the clock. And then the other half of the time he would cancel the meeting after I'd made the trek and done the preparation mm-hmm. to get to the meeting. He was just totally disorganized, which made me completely lose confidence in him as a leader.
Made me question
why the organization would put up with this. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that creates a lot of cynicism in an organization, too. Because you realize you've got this kind of incompetence at a level above you, and you go, why am I working for somebody like this?
And the other thing that it does, and I've noticed this in another situation, which was actually a work situation where I was in a paid position, but the leader above me was so disorganized that I would continue to come to meetings so prepared and trying so hard and trying to get things done and cross things off a list. But yet the leader's job never got done. And so eventually I stopped performing because it didn't matter what I did. It never got followed through on.
Yeah.
It never got carried through. So at some point, my own performance started to back off because why kill yourself setting things up that never got finished, you know, that never got carried forward.
Well, the same boss I was talking about, I had a similar situation because sometimes there were decisions that needed to be made that exceeded his approval level. So that meant that he had to be able to gather his research that I would mm-hmm. provide, go in and make a case to his boss to get the approval that I needed to move forward. He couldn't pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
He could not get approval. If it exceeded his approval level, I pretty much just had to cross it off. I just knew that he was never going to get the approval. He wasn't organized enough. He didn't have enough command of the facts. He wasn't persuasive or compelling. So let's stop there.
So what would you say to the leader that really does struggle with disorganization? How can they compensate for that or overcome it, even if it's truly one of their chief struggles?
Well, first of all, I think it sometimes is just it's not in somebody's genes or their mm-hmm. character or whatever. They're just not naturally organized, and mm-hmm. that's okay. But I think, first of all, to just recognize
some really creative people, not all, but some really, really creative people are, or even highly intelligent people, it's like they can't even manage all the ideas that they have. So they come across very disorganized.
So I think owning that, for starters, you know, maybe they need to be in a completely different role and they don't need to be in a role of leadership or management.
Okay.
But assuming that they are in that role, at the very least, get a highly organized administrative assistant or executive assistant that can keep track of your calendar, that can keep track of your commitment so that things don't fall through the cracks. Because ultimately, this will erode people's confidence in you and it'll affect your ability to lead and influence other people.
So interesting. I get to work with a lot of artists and people that travel and are on the stage. A lot of them can be disorganized. They're in this creative field. And almost all of them have a road manager that travels with them because that's part of that role is to have somebody that kind of is managing all those details so you can thrive doing what you're really good at.
Yep, absolutely.
Love it. Okay, so far we have, these are characteristics of lousy leaders. So our goal today is to avoid these or try to overcome them, compensate for them. But one, they don't have enough confidence to lead at their level. Two, they're arrogant, assuming they always know what's best. Three, they're disorganized. And four,
their words and actions erode trust, even with their supporters. So it may be that they simply don't have judgment. And so they'll say things or they'll do things that make people question, you know, what they're about. And this is why I think as leaders, we got to be conscious of the fact that our words carry weight, that our actions carry weight, that people read into it. Mm-hmm. And when we do things that are kind of in that gray area, that it can really erode trust. And so I think as leaders, we've got to be so above board, so committed to integrity that we never do anything that could be questioned or in the gray area that causes that trust to erode.
Which really, and this is kind of not really off topic, but that whole integrity, isn't it just about trying to say what's right? But you really have to live that first before, you know, to control what comes out of your mouth. You have to live integrity in order to be a person that actually speaks that way too.
You do. And I told the experience I had before of the exact opposite of that, this of a boss that I had at one point who had made a commitment to give me a raise after 90 days.
Yes.
It was a brand new job. And that if I was able to really do the work right and it was a new position for me, that he would give me this raise. But the company had a hiring freeze and a salary freeze in place by the time it came for my evaluation. And so rather than just dismissing that and saying, look, my hands are tied, blame it on the corporation, he reached into his own pocket and made up the difference and gave me the raise out of his own pocket. I didn't really have a choice. He said, you've got to take this. But it's the exact opposite of it. By his words and actions, he built trust so that still to this day, I'm profoundly impacted by that. And I've really ordered much of my own business life and my own understanding of integrity around that role model.
I tend to think of trust as being something that doesn't stay static. You either are eroding it or building it with
constantly.
Every decision and conversation that you have.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So words and actions erode trust even with their supporters. What's next?
The fifth one I would say is that they overpromise and underdeliver.
Oh, this is so, I mean, people do this so easily.
Politicians
without thinking.
Especially.
Yes. Yes. And it's dangerous because it goes back to trust again.
It's dangerous. And it's a fine line because usually when you're selling the future, so to speak, when you're describing what's to come, there's an element of faith. Mm-hmm. There's no certainty in it. You're trying to describe what you think you can deliver, but you can't be so far out there that you get people to buy into something that you couldn't possibly deliver. Mm-hmm. And this takes judgment. You know, a smart leader may fail on this one or two times, but then they learn. Now, there's a fine line here too, because I don't want to be the kind of leader, and I think this is another element of lousy leadership, which is where you way under promise, you know, and we used to call this in the corporate world, people probably still call this sandbagging, you know, like you're preparing against a flood, you're trying to you know, protect yourself in this situation rather than be honest about it. So I think you have to stretch, get a little outside of your comfort zone, but not overpromise. And you've got to then do everything to make your actions conform to your words. And this is the essence of integrity, is making our actions conform with our words. That builds trust.
All right. So they overpromise and underdeliver, which is so dangerous. We want to make sure that we keep our word. It's all about integrity. Let's go ahead and move on to number six. What is number six?
The sixth one is that they don't articulate a clear vision. This is one of the most important. In fact, I would argue the most important function of leadership. More than anything else, they've got to paint a picture of a better future. They've got to know clearly
multiple
where they're
times.
Headed. Multiple times. Again and again and again. If a leader doesn't know where he's going, doesn't have a clear destination in mind, how can he possibly bring anybody with him? Mm-hmm. Because whatever else leadership is, it's the ability to enroll other people in a journey going somewhere. If you don't know where the somewhere is, you know, you're just lost in the woods. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare, frankly, that leaders have vision. They might have some vision about the immediate future, but to have some vision about where this is all going and connect the dots so that people's little actions are connected to the bigger picture is rare. I worked for a man one time who had zero vision ability. You know, basically his only vision was make money and make more of it.
That's not usually a compelling enough
vision. No, it was really compelling to him because he wanted to be rich. Uh-huh. But it wasn't compelling to anybody else because we weren't really that interested in making him rich.
You weren't interested in him making money. So
no,
why
I
would
you kind of get interested in me making money, but I really, and I think this is true for most people, they're in it for more than the money.
There has to be something a little bit greater than
nothing
that.
Nothing wrong with money. No. You know, I usually want a little bit more
of an added value to it.
That's right. So
make money, change the world. Then that's a good combination.
Then it's a good thing, like Stu McLaren talks about. But in this case, what he did was he realized he wasn't casting vision because he was told that by a consultant. And so his solution to that, rather than get a real vision for himself and do the hard work of trying to understand where he wanted to take this organization, he called a committee together. I got appointed to the committee and he said, I want you guys to come up with a vision. So by committee, we tried to cobble together this vision. And I mean, it was better than nothing.
Yes.
But it was basically a vision born of compromise because that's what happens when a bunch of peers are working together. And the environment was political for other reasons that were related to this guy's leadership, but it was very political. And it was just kind of a watered down, pro forma kind of vision that could have belonged to any corporation, you know, basically do a better job serving our customers and, you know, creating excellent products and, you know, a bunch of stuff that makes people's eyes glaze over and makes them yawn.
I think I'm yawning right now.
I know. It's just,
so
just
what
wasn't
would
compelling.
You suggest as a better solution? What should he have done?
What he should have done, I think, and I think this is how you get vision as a leader. You have to carve out time in your schedule for reflection.
Okay.
And you have to think about the future. And most leaders do not spend adequate time thinking. But to really think about, where is this going? Like in a perfect world, if I could just wave a magic wand, 5 years, where would this organization be that it's not currently at? When I became a divisional leader at Thomas Nelson in the year 2000, I inherited a division that out of 14 divisions was dead last on every possible metric. And so the first thing
that would be fun. That was a nice inheritance, wasn't it?
Well, it was actually very good because I couldn't screw it up. It could only go one direction.
I love that positive attitude. Very nice. It was only going up from there.
So at first it was kind of like, yeah, you know, I got handed this thing that's kind of broken, but then I realized, no, this is a huge opportunity. Uh-huh. So the first thing I did was I went off on a retreat and I just started jotting down a series of bullets about what I wanted to see over the course of the next couple of years, because the CEO had asked me, how long is it going to take to turn this division around? And I did what a lot of managers do, and I just pulled an arrow out of the number, or a number out of the air. That's a different process.
Completely different. That's a different podcast, so even.
So I pulled a number out of the air, and I said 3 years, you know, and I had all the confidence, like I knew what I was talking about, but I really didn't have a clue. But I went off and I said, okay, so what could this look like in 3 years? And I was very concrete. I wrote it down as though it were present tense, though I was experiencing it, and as if it were a present reality. And then I went back, and this is the other common thing that leaders will do if they get a vision, is that they don't get back and seek the counsel of their colleagues or the people that report to them. They just, you know, come in like Moses from the mountain, hand the mission or the hand the vision and say, this is what we're going to do. Yes. Are you with me or against me? And if you're not with him, you get left off the team. So what I did was I went back with this vision that I saw as a rough draft. And I said to the team, look, here's what I see could happen. And I just want to know what you see. I want this to be something we collectively own. So this is just a starting place because I know it's tough to do this in a committee. So what else do you see? So by the time we were done with that process, everybody owned the vision. And it didn't take us 3 years. It took us 18 months. We went from number 14 to number one in 18 months. But it started by getting crystal clear on the destination, what it would look like when we finally accomplish the vision.
I love that. So that last one was, they don't articulate a clear vision. All right, we have four more characteristics of a lousy leader, but We are going to take a short break right now, so stick with us. We'll be right back.
As a busy and successful blogger, podcaster, author, speaker, and consultant, I'm constantly asked about the tools I use to get it all done. Now, for the first time, I'm going to pull back the curtain and let you peek inside my toolbox to see the software and hardware I use for everything from blogging and podcasting to productivity, social media, and speaking, plus so much more. You can't buy Inside My Toolbox, but you can get it for free by subscribing to my free email newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll receive my newest content right in your inbox. You'll never have to worry about missing an important post or update again. To get your free copy of the Inside My Toolbox ebook, visit michaelhyatt.com and enter your name and email address into the form on the page. Don't waste any more time or money using the wrong tools. Sign up today at michaelhyatt.com.
All right, so far we've walked through six characteristics of a lousy leader. I'm just going to recap these really quick. They don't have enough confidence to lead at their level. They're arrogant, assuming they always know what's best. They're disorganized. Their words and actions erode trust, even with their supporters. Number five, they overpromise and underdeliver. And six, they don't articulate a clear vision, which you said very clearly is so important.
So critical.
Perhaps the most important
job
on this whole list right here. Okay, so move on. What's number seven?
They don't enroll others in their initiatives. You know, they depend on coercion or force, or they think they can do it all themselves.
Mm-hmm. But, oh, I've seen a lot of that last one. Like the ones that are just like, well, I'm just going to do it myself. I'm going to do it myself.
And sometimes you get this attitude from these kinds of leaders like, well, my people are idiots or they just don't get it or they're lazy. No, you just haven't enrolled them in your vision. I was just at a board meeting where there was one of the leaders in the organization who was blaming the people that reported to him for why he wasn't delivering on the performance that he had promised to the board. And I didn't ask this question because I didn't feel it was appropriate in this larger context of the board meeting, but I wanted to ask him the question that had been asked of me before in a similar situation where I would say to him, what is it about your leadership that's led to this lack of performance? Mm-hmm. What is it about your inability to enroll the people under you? What is it about your inability to paint a compelling vision of the future? Because that enrollment process, if the first job is vision, the second job as a leader is enrollment. You've got to create alignment in your team. And the only way you do that is by knowing where you're going and then convincing people that they want to go there too, or helping them see that it's in their best interest or this is compelling in some way. It really comes down, I hate to use this term, but it's a matter of salesmanship. Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to sell the vision. And a lot of leaders don't have that ability.
Well, it takes time. And I think they just want to plow ahead with it rather than take the time to really create that alignment
they
and
do.
Get them enrolled in the process.
Let me tell you something. It's demagoguery or being a dictator is very efficient.
Okay.
But it's not very efficient when you don't have, you know, the threat of death hanging over people's heads.
Yes.
So it may work in some, you know, some country where they're not that sophisticated, you know, that's like a third world country or something. But it doesn't work in the real world where people are, and I think of everybody this way as a volunteer, even people that you're paying. You may get their physical presence, but you don't get their heart and you don't get them committed to the vision unless you enroll them in it. And coercion is not an option either. We see this a lot in the political sphere where people just try to muscle something through and just bludgeon the minority.
There's so much fallout.
Oh, so much fallout. The best leaders don't do that.
All right. So that seventh characteristic of a lousy leader, they don't enroll others in their initiatives. What is number eight?
They're not transparent.
So they're kind of shut off.
They're shut
Removed.
Off. They don't reveal anything. They're just like the Wizard of Oz. You know, they're behind a curtain.
Mm-hmm.
They don't tell you what they're thinking. They don't share any emotion. I worked for one corporation where they didn't share any of the performance metrics with any of the executive team. Because the leader was paranoid in that situation. He thought that if people had more information than he had, that he would be at a disadvantage. He didn't trust anybody. And he wasn't transparent. He didn't reveal anything about himself. The problem is, if you don't reveal anything about yourself, you don't take advantage of the most important thing you can use as a leader, which is your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And people who follow you don't expect you to be perfect. But when you're transparent and share your life, it enrolls them in the process.
Yes.
So transparency is hugely important. And of course, now we got a political environment in our country where people are so afraid of getting sued,
yes,
or the media taking things and twisting them and polarizing their constituents against them, that they're very reticent to share the very things that would really help move everything mm-hmm. forward. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's kind of pretending, posing.
At the same time, I think our culture is less tolerant of a lack of transparency than ever before. I mean, I think of some of like my kids, the millennial generation, some of these youngers, that they're all about transparency.
They are.
And if you don't, if you aren't transparent, they will shut you off so fast. I mean, that just tells them you can't be trusted. I'm done with you. And they will walk away.
Well, and I've learned the hard way that by being transparent in my family, by being transparent in the organizations I work in companies that I've run, that's one of the greatest leadership tools that you have mm-hmm. because it builds trust. Because
yes.
when you're transparent with the numbers, for example, just financial performance, whether it's good or bad, people learn to trust you, that you're going to tell them the truth. You're not going to mm-hmm. try to gloss over or spin the truth.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to number 9. What's the 9th characteristic of a lousy leader?
They're blind to what's happened in their own organizations.
Oh, and I've seen this. Let me just say.
Okay, so let me ask you for an example. Can you think of an example?
Okay, let me see if I can think. I had, and I don't know if this was true blindness or a willing blindness, like he was intentionally trying to stay blind, but I had an immediate manager in a job one time, and then there was another manager above him that was so inappropriate in how he handled situations. I mean, we're talking like HR should have been involved, mm-hmm. so inappropriate, and yet the immediate manager, the one that should have been like advocating for his staff and his team and whatever, just was blind to all these interactions that were going on, would never do anything about it, just pretended like it wasn't yeah. happening, just turned away every time. I mean, it was just, and we got so frustrated. First of all, he looked very weak because
yes.
he wasn't willing to go to bat for his team. And then you sit there and you actually even question his intelligence. Like, how could you not see this?
Right.
You know, surely you would do something if you saw this. Why are you not doing? So then you think he's not even sharp enough to pick up on what's going on. I mean, it just started to derail so many different things.
Well, and if it's not question his intelligence, you start to question his integrity. Like,
yes.
well, he says one thing with his lips.
Because silence is agreement. You know,
that's
that
right.
kind of idea.
That's
silence
right.
is agreement. He's not doing anything. He's not acknowledging it. So he must be in support. That means he's in alignment with the behavior that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. In one organization that I was working in, we had this exact same situation where there was a divisional leader who was an incredible performer. He hit mm-hmm. his numbers year after mm-hmm. year after mm-hmm. year. And the big boss was unwilling to deal with his unethical behavior. There was everything from allegations of sexual harassment to just out and out lying, fabricating mm-hmm. stories. There were a lot of red flags. But because he was a big performer, the leadership was willfully ignorant. That's what mm-hmm. I'm looking for. Willfully ignorant.
So blind, but not, I mean, like doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
Like choosing to stay blind.
Choosing to stay blind because they didn't want to have to deal with what they would do to replace him for the sake of performance. And I see that in a lot of organizations that happens, maybe not that blatantly, mm-hmm. but sometimes people are willingly ignorant. Sometimes it's because leaders are just, you know, they're kind of ensconced inside of the C-suite, they call it, you know, mm-hmm. the corporate suite, and they just don't venture out where the real people live.
True. I've seen that too, where they just kind of stay in their yeah. office, do their thing. They never go and interact with their staff.
And it even happened to me when I was a CEO, because you're depending on filtered information,
mm-hmm.
right? So you want to trust the people that are reporting to you, but obviously, and they don't do this because they're malicious or because they're unethical, but they're going to give you their perspective.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't ever dig any deeper than that, you don't get any other perspective. One of the first things I did when I became the president of Thomas Nelson's was introduce this practice called Pizza with the Prez. And so what I did was, department by department, I got the people that were working at that level, many, many levels below me, just to have lunch with me. We brought in pizza and then we just chatted and I asked them a couple questions. And one of the questions was, what don't you want in this company to change because you think it's so valuable and, mm-hmm. and you don't want us to screw it up by taking it away or changing it? And then I tried to build some trust in just in that discussion. I said, okay, is there anything that if you could be the CEO for a day that you would immediately change? I got amazing.
I would imagine that was some
people.
Of the most valuable time you've ever spent.
And I really respected what they shared with me and I did not reveal it anywhere else. I uh-huh. took it as a problem to be solved, not somebody to be punished. whether it was they were ratting out somebody else or whatever, but they would just, we try to keep it
really
issue.
But you created a real safe environment for that conversation.
Yep.
But it kept you, the point being, it kept you from kind of operating blind in your position.
That's right.
You like intentionally created scenarios that gave you opportunity to see what's really going on.
And as a leader, you have to do that. I think one of the great advantages of email, frankly, and I saw this when email came in. I mean, gosh, it was back in the late 80s, but when email came online, suddenly the hierarchy began to flatten. Because you didn't have to pass a physical memo kind of up the ranks to the top. And so I would encourage and have people email me all the time. When I was the CEO of Thomas Nelson, I'd have people at the very lowest levels of the corporation send me a note or tell me about a situation that needed to be addressed. And it takes time and it takes building trust.
Yes. That actually somewhat goes back to the whole transparency. Even your,
it does.
Your accessibility kind of created this sense
That's
of transparency.
Right. You've got to invite it. You can't punish it when it happens. You've got to actually demonstrate that you're going to do something about it. I remember one of those Pizza with the Press meetings, I had a woman who, I said, what's the biggest problem you're facing? She said, I am out of file space. And she happened to work in our legal department. She said, "I when I have to get a contract out, I literally have to pry the other files back so that I can quickly grab the file that I need and pull it out because everything's so jammed in there. And when I have to get a new file in there, I mean, there's no room." And I'm thinking, really? I mean, how much could it cost to have to order a file? So we got into that meeting, and then I contacted her supervisor, and I said, I want you to order this woman a new file cabinet. I said, trust me, you'll make her day. All of her problems will go away. She'll think you're a hero.
She was like, yay!
Just do it. And so I never really told him the whole story. I definitely didn't rat her out. He did it, and she was over the moon. A little simple thing like
so
that.
So small. But if you don't make the time for those kind of conversations, you never know.
No. And if you don't act on the information you get, you
True.
Lose credibility also.
True.
It's like, well, we told the guy what we need, and it's still not happening.
So you don't want to be blind to what's happening in your organization. What's the final characteristic of a lousy leader?
They don't hold their people accountable, and especially themselves.
Oh, that's big.
Always have
this
an excuse.
Huge.
You know, there's
yes.
there's these certain organizations, and we've seen them before, where it's almost impossible to get fired because there's no accountability. All kinds of...
You know what? Accountability is healthy, and we've had such a
healthy.
Hard time accepting that, but accountability is so healthy in a family, in a church, in an organization. It's so critical.
And
Two
it
ways.
Begins by holding yourself accountable.
Yes.
So that if you said you were going to deliver something, and you don't deliver it, you fess up. You own it. That's the only way to improve. That's the only way to grow as a leader. But hold yourself accountable and then hold your people accountable. And what that looks like is asking the hard questions. And I think people appreciate that. It creates discipline in a team. People grow. People that aren't performers that don't want to be held accountable will leave the organization, which is a really good thing. And you'll attract people
That's
that
true.
Are willing to be held accountable, who are willing to do what it takes to deliver. And if you want to build a performance-based culture, accountability is crucial.
All right. I have one final question for you. We only have just a short time left, but I think this is important. So is it possible to have lousy leader moments without being a lousy leader? So I look at this list and I go, all right, I can probably come up with instances that I've done almost every single one of these. So can I have lousy leader moments without being a lousy leader?
Yes, you can. I mean, I had a couple this week myself.
I'm so relieved.
And I mean, seriously. And what when you become a lousy leader is when this becomes a pattern of behavior and this becomes the predominant way that you relate to the people you're trying to lead. So no leader is going to be perfect. The opposite of a lousy leader is not a perfect leader. But it's a leader who is informed by these and trying to do the exact opposite and working and growing and becoming a better leader.
You know, we gave you a lot of different characteristics today of lousy leaders. And, you know, for those achievers out there, you're going to want to go and try to be perfect at all these. Let's not do that.
Yeah,
I'm just giving you permission to breathe. But, you know, start with one. You know, if you see that you're disorganized, then start with trying to figure out a plan for more organization or hiring that excellent assistant, executive assistant to help you, whatever it may be. Pick one or two. Start working on these. We're all in progress. But the goal is to move toward thriving in leadership rather than being a lousy leader. Well, if you've enjoyed today's conversation, you can get all the show notes and a full transcript of the entire episode at michaelhyatt.com. In addition, if you'd prefer to watch the video rather than audio, we have the whole thing recorded and again posted at michaelhyatt.com. And I have a favor to ask. This is so important. If you could take just a few seconds, if you could head over to iTunes, we'd love for you to rate the program. It's the best way to get this content into as many hands as possible. Do you have anything to add at this point?
Yeah, I do. I think I would add is that you got to decide what kind of leader you're going to be. To be self-aware, self-conscious, and intentional about it. Do you want to be a lousy leader? Do you want to be a great leader? And then begin to shape the decisions you make, the stuff you consume, the way that you relate to people. But the choice is really in your hands.
Excellent counsel. Thank you, Michael. Well, thank you for being with us today. We've so enjoyed having you here. Until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Do what matters.